So, children, here is a first question, and it goes like this. Why has infant baptism been established? I will answer you in just a few words, because we already spoke about this last time, when we talked about the need for Orthodox catechism, which is supposedly postponed until a person grows up, now that infant baptism has become the established practice. Quite simply, because a family that has children would not want the children of the household to remain far from the Holy Chalice. Let us not forget that baptism is the gate through which we enter the Church. Let us also not forget that through baptism, the demons are driven out and expelled. Sometimes, when you go to a baptism, the priest takes the child along with the godparent, and there, near the front of the church, they are turned toward the west. Listen, then, to the prayers, which are exorcisms. That is to say, this work of the church is carried out so that the devil may be cast out, so that the devil may not lie hidden, so that he may not be concealed within the person. In this way, we accomplish two things. On the one hand, we drive the nest of Satan out of the person, and on the other, we bring the person near to the cup of life, the Holy Eucharist. And what is more, since we also have deaths of children, in due time, this ought to be done once and for all, a single time. And so infant baptism was established, and we should not let much time pass. Rather, the child should be baptized quickly, so that it may receive Holy Communion, so that it may be saved. If we suppose that it dies, you understand that it is a serious matter, a serious sin, if it has not been baptized. So these, let us say, are the things, in a first approach, that established infant baptism. And now, we come to a second question. It is well known that at the stadiums there are riots and disturbances. But even in our simplest games, between winners and losers, there arise hard feelings. After all, what is the purpose of a game? This is a serious subject, as you can appreciate. Indeed, at the stadiums we have now reached this sorry state where riots break out, and many times even bloody ones. Some people end up dying, I do not know for what reason, or else, as they try to leave the stadium, or something happens, somehow they get trampled underfoot among themselves. This is not at all a rare occurrence. Only a few years ago, at a stadium in Attica, people were trampled as they tried to get out. So if someone buckles, falls, or stumbles, oh dear, the others fall on top of him, and then it is over. He has been trampled, you can no longer get up. That is the end. One might ask, are these fitting things? And because we have a very strange notion of freedom and of the people's entertainment, the evil keeps going from bad to worse. I do not know what it would be that could restrain this evil. Remember, last Sunday what happened, even though here the local team had won. They burned a policeman's motorcycle. Why? What was the reason? Just so we can say we are doing what, exactly? To make a commotion. To do what? What for? Precisely. You see that we are dealing with sheer madness. If you like, we have departed from the very meaning of a game, because football is a game. It is play, after all. We even say it, the game went well, and so on, meaning the football. But I would not want to stay only on football. I would like to speak about play more generally. Play is a need of the human being. Children, pay attention. Because it is not only football, I say again. You see, we say, let us play chess. Or, in the old days we played tag and hide and seek. These were not only girls' games, they were also the boys' games, and all of us played them. Indeed, I must tell you which were the lovely games of a bygone era. Today they are no longer played. No, they are not played, because they have grown old-fashioned. The outlook of young people today has changed. Today children do not play. That is, they do not play in the sense we will explain a little further on. Today, children do something else. They make a racket. They become antisocial elements. They do things by which they themselves are harmed and harm others. So it is no longer that old era when a child played at home or in his neighborhood. The children would gather in open spaces, in the neighborhood, even in the street, streets that were not so crowded with people or with vehicles. They played whatever games belonged to that era, of which, just to give you an idea. I would have many to tell you, names of games, but I mention hide and seek and tag. When we played hide and seek, it was my joy. Especially in a wooded spot that also had mastic shrubs, where we could hide with ease. And indeed at the hours when evening was already falling, what can I say to you? I will never forget the sweetness of that game. Hide and seek. We played and took delight and laughed and rejoiced. And we did not quarrel. Today, these things do not exist. And perhaps the matter should be studied. Today I heard. Today. Here is a conclusion that is a shock, that the toys which are manufactured, and which have nothing in common with the old games, become the cause of death for between 50 and 80,000 children a year in Europe. Because, it is said, there are certain substances, and a child, being a child. Indeed it was a remark I heard this, a remark, that a child, it says, wants the toy to be his own, it is his possession. True enough, but he also wants to bite it, if he is at a young age to eat it. And this substance, this material that he will eat, is, it says, expanding, in those very words, and then it swells up inside the stomach, and the child can suffer harm. Do you hear? Remember certain erasers that smelled of chocolate, that smelled of cherry, that smelled of cherry, that smelled in our early days. I do not know if they still exist, and the children, as they smelled, there were rubber erasers, how they smelled. To tell you the truth, even I long to bite into such an eraser. So how much more a child? But this is a chemical substance which will do harm. It unquestionably does harm. Then there are toys whose mechanical nature, many mechanical toys, they cause injuries and many other harms. So an appeal is being made for this whole approach to change, since the appeals are simply ignored by the toy merchants, by the toy manufacturers. At the very least, those toys that can cause harm or death should be banned, should not exist at all. Not just advice. Parents, watch out for your children. No, they have to be forbidden outright. So the toy is no longer what it once was. And today, on top of that, the toy is a luxury and an expensive one. Suppose a child asks for a toy. The father, the mother, may say, "We don't have the money," because it costs a great deal, many thousands, some machine that launches rockets at you from Mars. But that kind of thing is extremely expensive. Children, if I told you how we amused ourselves in the old days, if I told you, what can I say? Let me tell you about the cane we turned into a little horse. You know it. The small child lives in his world of imagination. So he would ride the cane. He even had a little whip. He would strike the cane from behind to make it go. And of course he used his own legs to make the horse run. And the child became a horse. He went riding. Even the doll. I remember once in my father's village there was a mill there, a windmill, and there was a girl, the Florin. And since these are islands in the Aegean Sea, in the Aegean they call them, the feminine and the masculine become neuter. Just as you hear in Thessaly say the Yanis, that is, Yanis, you make the masculine feminine. There they make them neuter, they make them so. I even remember her name because she was right next to my grandfather's bakery. We were small children, the Florin, that is Flora the Florin. Well, she was inside the mill was round, and around it she had little dolls. The little dolls were stones, and she dressed them in little skirts. She was older than us. We were quite small. She dressed them up, little dolls, and she had them all around in a row. I remember my sister, who used to. She loved the idea of becoming a teacher. She never did become a teacher, of course. But when I came back from school, she would take some stones, set them in a row as if they were the pupils. And so now she would take a little stick. Tell me, 3 and 5, how much is that? 8, the stone would say. Tell me, 7 and 5, how much is that? 11, 12, take a smack of the stick. So you understand we amused ourselves. Listen, very cheaply. I remember it all of it, my father, my mother. I once bought a little boat. It was a New Year's gift on Aeolu Street, and it cost 20 drachmas. I don't remember any other toy we bought apart from that little boat of 20 drachmas. Why? Because we knew how to play with nothing, whereas today we want expensive toys. But the worst thing is that we have lost the purpose of play. And now I come to tell you that the purpose of play is first, psychological. Second, recreational. Third, pedagogical. Let us look at these. The child, by its nature, loves to play. So it lies within the child's psychology. And if you ask why it is in the child's psychology, God in His great wisdom made all small creatures, from the child to the kitten to the puppy, all the little ones, to leap. You see the kittens from the very start. You see the dogs from the very start. All of them leap, run, move. The little lambs, the little kids, all of them. Why? Because its skeleton needs to set firm, and God has placed this tendency in the little one to play. precisely so that its skeleton may set, or that everything may set, as we would say of a human being, so that he may grow to maturity. The grown person does not play. How would it seem to you to see your mother playing the way a small child plays, hopping about? It would be strange, very strange indeed. The grown woman, or the father, has no need to play with the kind of movements a child makes. So that is the first thing. The second, I told you, is the recreational. The child wants to amuse itself. It wants to pass the time, and so it plays with a toy. But it plays, yes, and sometimes there are games the child plays on its own. There are such games it plays by itself, making certain combinations, building something, and so on. And the third is that play has a pedagogical character. On this, I would like to dwell a little. On the pedagogical character, pay attention. Girls, as you know, love dolls, or they used to love them. Now, I don't know whether they play with dolls anymore. It is a very, very deep love of the little girl to have a doll. She puts it to sleep, then it wakes up, and there are dolls that open and close their eyes. She has to dress it, wash it, feed the doll, all of that, talk to the doll, sometimes sleep with the doll in her bed. And do you know why all this? The girl is preparing to become a mother, and she prepares herself by playing. She prepares herself by playing. The boy does not play with dolls, but he too plays. He takes stones, bricks, little sticks, as a small boy. If you only knew how I long to have little squared pieces of wood, something like this, that is, not wood like firewood, just nicely cut on the machine, or bricks, even to this day. If I see a brick, take it, I say. When we have so many bricks, if I see little sticks of wood nicely cut on the machine, I tell you truly, even to this day. It is the unfulfilled longing of my childhood, because think how much wood we have at the monastery, the pieces we take out of the machine, the offcuts. They pile up, so why don't you use them? We'll throw them away. And I think, if you're going to throw them away, I'd love to take them and play. Watch closely and see what a child does. What a boy does. He builds. He makes little houses. He builds. He makes towers. And he does it again, because the child is getting ready to become, you see, a creator. Tomorrow he'll build his own house, or he'll become an artist. In those days there was no drawing paper, or the sketch pads were expensive. That is what we called them. Sketches, you'd call them that now too. Sketches we called them. Well, buying a sketch pad was expensive. I remember my mother. She'd get butcher's paper from the butcher. Those big sheets they wrap the meat in. And if they still exist, unless some new packaging has come in, I don't know. So she'd buy a few sheets of butcher's paper, cut them, stitch them together at the edge for me. And I was very small. She would buy a few sheets of butcher's paper, cut them, sew them at the edge for me. I was very small. And she would tell me, I also had a few crayons. And she would tell me, draw. Oh, that, draw. To have paper. Whereas today, paper is everywhere. Where would you find it back then? This was before the war. Before the 40s. I'm not a young man. I'm an old one. So, paper. Oh, paper. To draw on. The boy is creative. Creative, he is creative. And he is preparing for life. To become a creative person. So play is not just something casual. Oh, there, as it happens, it has important elements. And I stress the last element, as I told you, the pedagogical one. The child must learn through play to mature, to grow up, to acquire what it ought to acquire. Acquire what? First of all, to acquire character, when it plays with the other child, the so-called social games. Because I will tell you this too, the very small child, the one under 10 years old, psychology says that the child calls another child of its own age a friend. Not because it wants the friend to play and to be glad, but because it wants to use him so that it itself may be glad, consequently. The other is the object within the game, so that the child, this one here, may have its joy. Because the child under 10 is individualistic, it is not social. When the child enters adolescence, after 12, when it plays, it wants to play and to share its joy and its game with the other child. That is, the social sense begins to awaken within him. But if this social sense is awakening, and it ought to be cultivated through play, then let me ask you, if he plays only to quarrel, then when he grows up, he will become a self-centered person who fights with everyone around him. No, he will not quarrel. He will want to share the joy of the game between himself and the other, so that they rejoice together. Suppose there are games where we say you won, you lost. If the other person won, be glad for him. Never mind. Another time you will win. Because if you grow bitter, if you become envious, if you strike the other, if you lose your temper, then without question, you do not know how to play, you do not know how to play. Either you never found the teaching purpose within the game, or others did not help you find it. Your parents did not help you, or I do not know who else. You see, this is no small matter, and look how much time we are spending, so that I can tell you these things. Whole volumes have been written on the subject of play and the child. If you want my honest word, it is no small thing. It is a very serious matter. Therefore, why should we fight with the other? Why should I grow bitter? He won, I won. No jealousy, no spite, no hostility, nothing of the sort. That is beautiful. And indeed, I remember in the old days, it used to be said in the old Christian groups, the opponent has won. Opponent meaning simply the one we are playing a game against. And we would congratulate him with our own hand. We would offer him our congratulations. You have won. Say we are playing football. How many are playing? 5-6 on each side, 11 in all. Except, well, say 5.5 against 5.5. Let us put it that way. 5.5 players and 5.5 players. So the 5.5 players go and congratulate the other 5.5 players. Very good. They say, you have won. Our congratulations to you. Now blows are exchanged because, mark me well, we have lost the meaning of the game. So you understand, children, that today the children, sadly, do not play this way. The meaning and the purpose of play have been lost. But let us rediscover it. Let us not go looking for luxurious toys. Let us look for simple things. Once I made a chess set for a friend of mine, and I made it with a little penknife cutting branches from pine trees in particular, and I had made it. Let me tell you how I made it. It was during the time when the bombardments were happening. Yes, yes, under the occupation, bombings or strafing, or sometimes nothing was happening. We were simply in the shelters, and in the shelters we lived for hours on end. Whether by night or by day, hours upon hours we lived in the shelters, waiting for the sirens to sound again that the alarm had ended. So what is one to do there? I remember, with a little penknife, I carved an entire chess set and gave it as a gift to a friend of mine. I was about 17 years old when I made it. So let us rediscover. Children, the purpose of play. Let them play. There is even a phenomenon when a child has not played, for whatever reason, he wants to play when he grows up or grows old. This is called second childhood, becoming a child again. Psychology says this is not an abnormal psychological condition, but simply that this grown person, when he was a child, never played. And because I myself only played until I was 11 or 12 years old. And the reason, well, back then the times were good, afterward we were struggling only to survive and not to play. That is why sometimes I would truly long to play again with little children, to play once more, to become a man in his second childhood. That is, to become a child again. So much for that question. Let us look at one more thing in the very few minutes that remain. There is, forgive me, a third question. What is your opinion about video? May we watch it? Now mark me well, children, the video is neutral, in itself neutral, as far as its operation and use are concerned. If you record good things, you will see good things and beneficial ones. If you record filthy things, you will see filthy things. And of course, they will not be beneficial, they will be destructive. It is exactly like the tape of a tape recorder you see now, right here in front of me. I am speaking to you and there is a tape recording, just as you over there are also recording. We never said the tapes are something evil. We can record on the tapes. But what should we record? We should record good things. So too with the videotape, let us record good things. And indeed, if fine works are circulating, with a Christian spirit and so forth, which one can obtain and watch? And mark this especially. Here, if we do not have a television set, but only a simple screen. Because when there is a television, and I think if I were to ask you, which household does not have a television? Let the child raise his hand. I believe no child would raise his hand to say that there is no television in your home, or a television, as some have set up. Take note, the evil is very great. But in this case, if there is only a single screen on which you cannot receive a program from outside, but only project what the videotape contains, then there is no problem. And if these tapes are lovely, with good content, or even from your own life, you go somewhere. You go on an outing. I do not know what. You film scenes from one of your outings, from anything at all, and at some point you project these and watch them. That is not a bad thing. It is a fine thing. So I would have nothing to say against this matter. It depends on the use we make of it. There is one more I would have very much liked to speak about it. But in any case, let me cover the 4 minutes. There are the so-called student hangouts. May we frequent them. What is your opinion? Mark me well, children, on the matter of hangouts. First of all, the word hangout passed over from the language of those, and so on, into the vocabulary of students. A student in the old days never used to say hangout. And it is, I think, a corruption. It belongs to slang. Do you know what slang means? It is a French word, argot. It is a coarse, guttural kind of language, one that carries hidden meanings. And I do not know what else. I work out the etymology of the word on my own. It must come, perhaps, from the verb to stand. That is, the place where I linger, where I stand, where I sit in order to meet the others. These hangouts, which even the municipalities set up, exist to gather the young people. In essence, they are nothing but an evolved coffee house, just like the cafeterias and the hangouts as well. In reality, they are an evolved coffee house, and to the coffee house, children first of all, women never went in the old days, for a woman to be found in a coffee house was unthinkable. Much less did students go there. The school principal would make his rounds and look inside, especially if it was a small town or a village, to see whether any student might be in the coffee house. For a student to go to the coffee house was an unthinkable thing. Do not tell me that we now live in a different age. Yes, but this different age is not a better one. Because what we call progress, whatever is new, does not mean it is also better. If you want me to give you the definition of progress, not everything labeled progressive is so. If it is better, that is progress. If it is not better, then it is not progress. But going backward, we are moving in reverse, what under other circumstances we would call a return to barbarism. We turn back, as if to a kind of barbarism, and therefore we do not have progress when the thing is destructive. So I would say that a child who has the awareness, the consciousness, that he is a spiritual child, let him know this place. And now, children, we come to look at the questions that were submitted. A first question says the following. Nobility is a virtue that is an ornament for a person. In truth, let me open a parenthesis here. Is it still considered an ornament? Because today the ornament is held to be insolence. Today you are considered the strong, forceful person when you have no nobility, but are instead brazen. I close the parenthesis. I continue with the question. It was even described as a cosmetic of the soul. But how can we acquire it so that its fragrance may become perceptible in us and in those around us? I would like you to mention for us a few characteristic examples of nobility, of course, on this subject from Holy Scripture. Thank you. Let us see. For nobility to develop naturally, my children, there have to be certain preconditions in a person. And those preconditions, if I may put it this way, have to be structural. That is, a person has to be noble by his very structure. I can't, of course, put it just that simply. Because I'm not, forgive me, a pig. No matter how much you wanted to make it a noble animal, can never become one. Because by its structure, it is made to wallow in the mud. A cat, if you throw something dirty onto it, immediately starts licking itself clean. Grooming its fur, you see, by her very structure, the cat is clean, and by its very structure, the pig is unclean. So then, when we speak of nobility, we have to know that the human being has a certain structure of nobility. What does nobility mean? To be from a good lineage, UU and genos. That is, a good stock. It is like what we say of people of wealth, of education, of high office, of social standing. In the old days, they were called the noble ones. That is what they were called. Today, of course, we no longer have noble and common. Everyone has been leveled, but that is what the nobles were called. In older times, noble. That one is descended, it says, from a lineage of the noble. So then, if this is how things stand, then let us look at where our own lineage comes from. So that we may speak of how the human being, by his structure, is noble, that he has the preconditions of nobility. The Apostle Paul says, in his address to the Athenians, for of him, meaning God, For of him, meaning God, we too are the offspring. We are of the lineage of God. The Apostle Paul did not say this from himself. He simply made use of it. The ancient Greeks used to say it, that I am the offspring of God. But it takes on, we might say, a God-inspired dimension, that we are of the lineage of God. What does this mean? If God is God, and we are of his stock, his lineage, we are descended from God. And how are we descended? By being the image of God and by having the capacity to become like God. Then indeed we are of the lineage of God. That is, we are noble. So we have, by our structure, we have this nobility. The human being, then, is fashioned to stand noble. That is why he is noble. Now, nobility is nothing other than a fruit of Christian cultivation. When you pass from the image, which is the nobility, your structure, into the likeness, which is the rendering of all that you yourself will achieve, this is nothing other than the fruit of spiritual cultivation. We have many Christians, but unfortunately without, we might say, this Christian cultivation, and that is why nobility too is lacking. But how can nobility be rendered? Let us understand that nobility is not that narrow thing. The way we think of it, saying, come in please, sit down please, you're cold please, would you like a glass of water please? Oh, thank you, those things we say, the ones that are of course written in a book called Savoir Vivre, that is, what we'd call a guide to good manners. That is not nobility, my children. Nobility has something very broad about it. It is like a wide spectrum. Nobility is the rendering of a soul cultivated widely and deeply. A cultivated soul, that is nobility. So we would say that nobility is rendered when there is love, humility, discernment, respect, honesty, objectivity, not that dreadful subjectivism and individualism and selflessness. I've named a few like this. There are many. It is the whole repertoire of the virtues. We also see that nobility is cultivated even in the world. The word world we put in quotation marks. I've seen that I find even worldly people, not spiritual ones, who are noble. This is, of course, because the human being, by his nature, by his structure, is fashioned to be noble. But unfortunately, when the seal of the Holy Spirit is absent, then the worldly noble person falls short in his motives. Notice this point, he falls short in his motives. Because when you say, come in, please, or whatever else, thank you very much, or you show hospitality, these are often from a motive that is selfish, or a pride, so that you may appear to be noble, when you do not have the deeper motive, which is love. People in the world, many times, do not have love to express their nobility, but they have learned to be noble. When they eat, not to eat with the mouth open and smack their lips, so that you'd think a goat is eating or whatever else. All these things are not, notice me. They are forms of the world. They are not something dictated by the Spirit of God. Whereas, on the contrary, the cultivation of the soul, that is, when we say cultivation, we mean when the soul appears with a magnanimity, with a purity, with a sense of hospitality, with kindness. All these are the things that will give you good motives, surely, from the Spirit of God, for you to be the noble person. The noble person, my children, is a treasure. He is a beautiful person. I would tell you, if you wear jewelry, boys and girls, on the boys, you sometimes see someone with a chain. I'm not speaking of the earrings on the boys, because there it has another meaning. A goldsmith was telling me. He said, ah, how it grieves us when grown young men come to me, here, to pierce their ears so they can put in an earring, because they wear an earring. And I say, how do you pierce them? There is a machine, he says, like they do there. I remember in the old days, when they used to cover buttons with the fabric a lady bought to make the trim. Her dress. So then, there is a machine that makes a hole in the ear, and they put a little tube in there. Some tiny thing, so that it heals and the hole doesn't close up, so she can wear earrings. My goodness! And the girls who now put on earrings. How ugly it is, how immodest it is. I know the question is going to come up. And you'll ask me, why is it immodest for us to wear earrings? My children, do you want beautiful jewels, unchanging, very striking? It is virtue, it is nobility. The other person won't turn to look at you when you smell of perfume, or have trinkets, or wear jewelry. He'll turn, but it will be the cunning way in which he turns to look at you. But when he sees a nobility, you will nail down his every cunning movement and desire. You will pin it down, you will nail down his cunning desire, he will respect you. There is no more beautiful jewel than nobility. But which nobility? Not the worldly kind. The one that comes out of the spiritual life, out of the cultivated soul I was telling you about earlier. But so as not to stay on this longer, let us look also at a few examples I was asked to give. I would tell you that Abraham was a very noble man. It seems that Abraham was a tall and handsome man. I mean what we call a man of fine and noble bearing in his outward appearance, because there is also a nobility of the body, when we have a person who carries himself with a certain grace and dignity, whether man or woman. But do not be afraid, do not be alarmed. There are also people of small stature, who do not have what we call an outward gracefulness. It does not matter, as long as the inner gracefulness is there. So Abraham had outward gracefulness and nobility, but he also had inner nobility. He had a generosity. He had the sense of hospitality. Remember how he welcomed the three, who were none other than the Holy Triune God, that is, a type of the Holy Trinity. Once on behalf of the king of Sodom, he fought a war and utterly defeated that king who had, it is a long story, who had taken the king of Sodom captive. Along with that, king he had also captured the people, and he had captured his nephew, Lot as well, and so on. He fought a battle. He pursued them with his 318 household men, and he brought back the captives. Then the king of Sodom said that he wanted to give him his horses, his cavalry, to give him things. No, you will give me nothing, not even a lace of my shoes. Listen, this is not mine. It says, so there in Holy Scripture, not even a lace of my shoes will you give me. He showed himself the beautiful man, beautiful in soul. And then Isaac, a wonderful man. Most noble. He always dealt with nobility toward his envious neighbors. The neighboring peoples, he would dig a well, find water, and the neighbors would come and take it from him. He would leave, he did not quarrel. He did not shout, the noble man. He would leave and go further on with his sheep, and so forth, and dig another well. When he dug the other well too and found water, again they would run to seize it from someone. He never grew angry. At one point, when they saw he had such goodness, the plunderers themselves felt pity for him and said to him. They said they would now make an agreement, that they would no longer take from him the last well he had dug. And again, the Apostle Paul, that great and noble soul, who never burdened anyone, who thanked everyone. Remember there in Philippians, where they sent him some money, and he thanks them warmly. He is a prisoner in Rome, in the prison of Rome, and they sent it to him there through Epaphroditus and so on. And he says, why did you send to me? Well, it would have been no trouble. I have learned. I have seen. I know. I am content. That is, in the state I am in, to be content. To have what I have, and nothing more. But still, I rejoiced very much at your offering, which is as a fragrant aroma to God. He thanks them. He tells them so many things. And he says that their gift was as a fragrant aroma to God. Most nobly, I see him there in the Apostle Paul. Again, he speaks without wounding. He speaks in a beautiful manner to the Thessalonians, and wherever else in his epistles, we see him being noble so as not to wound. We also see that he has a deep love for man in general, with a capital letter, whoever he may be, in whatever condition he may be, whether poor or rich, free or slave, man or woman, educated or uneducated. A wonderful example, because all of this is nobility, is his epistle to Philemon. It is a monument of nobility, of love, of humaneness, and of nobility. He took in Philemon's slave, Onesimus, made him a Christian, and sent him back, saying, I did not want to keep him on your behalf, to keep him myself so that he could serve me, because I do not have your permission, since one of us is in Rome, the other in Asia Minor. That is why I am sending him back to you, but I am sending him to you as something more than a slave. I am sending him to you as a brother, a beloved one. Because now he has been baptized, because now he has come to believe, because now, and so forth. And what does he say? Take him in, receive him, accept him. That is, my very heart. That is, if you receive him, you receive my heart, my very feelings, you receive my heart. Because I have placed, Onesimus, your slave, within my own heart. This is nobility. This is the nobility of the wound. Truly beautiful nobility. What else shall I tell you? Shall I tell you about the evangelist Luke? Most noble, most noble. That is why he takes note. Wherever he meets nobility, he records it, either in his gospel or in the Acts. I will remind you, when in Malta, in Malite, those shipwrecked who came out onto the land, there it is written thus, and the natives, the local people that is, showed us no ordinary kindness. They gave us, he says, they offered us no ordinary nobility, for having kindled a fire, they welcomed us all, because of the rain that was upon us and because of the cold. Notice then, the nobility there of the natives, of the Malicians. When afterward the Apostle Paul became acquainted with the ruler of the island and healed his father, who suffered from rheumatism. Some kind of debilitating rheumatism, something of that sort he had. And now they were leaving to go to Rome, because Paul was a prisoner. He had to be handed over to the garrison commander there in Rome. He writes, who also honored us with many honors. With many honors they honored us. They were kindly toward us, and as we were departing, they provided what we needed. They gave us to take along with us whatever we had need of. Money, provisions they bestowed on us. Nobility, from whom? The natives, the Malicians. Again the Apostle Peter will write, finally, all of you be of one mind, sympathetic, loving as brothers, tender-hearted, courteous. The courteous one is the noble one. Let us be noble, he says. Courteous. You see then, I have given you both persons and teaching, very quickly, from Holy Scripture. Those who all stood as saints were gentle, every one of them. You cannot be a saint and stay merely courteous, but these are just a couple of words to give you a picture. And now we move on to another question. The question goes like this. When someone pushes a friend of his into sin, a very common thing, then who does the greater harm? The one who falls into the trap, or the other, who, in a sense, pushes him into sin? Here, children, we have a typical case of scandalizing, typical characteristic. That is, what does it mean to push someone into sin? It means I scandalize the other person. They scandalize him. If, for example, I tell him to eat while it is a fast, I have scandalized him. Or, if I push him into any sin, I have created a stumbling block for him. That is what scandal means. Scandal, literally, means a stake. It is a stake driven into the ground. I unsuspecting am walking. I trip and I fall. That is what it means to be scandalized. That is, I tripped. So, when you push the other person, the other tripped. That is, he fell. He was scandalized. He fell into a sin. The question is, who has the greater sin? The Lord says here, but whoever shall scandalize one of these little ones who believe in me, it is better for him that a millstone be hung around his neck, and that he be drowned in the depth of the sea. It is better that you take your own life. That is, you will have less sin in Hades and hell, if you kill yourself, than if you scandalize someone. Not be scandalized, scandalize. That is, push the other person to fall into sin. And indeed, he says, the one who scandalizes, one of these little ones, little both in age and in social standing. First of all, if one of your teachers, a teacher of yours, I say a woman teacher, because a question came up, she says, our teacher told us such and such. If a teacher in general tells his students things that will make them stumble and fall into sin or into unbelief, things like, who is Jesus Christ, anyway? And what does purity even mean? That is all nonsense. That person is pushing them. So he gives offense to whom? To the little ones. The little ones who believe in me, as the Lord says, little in age. But the simple, ordinary people are little ones too. Whoever gives offense to such a one by the things he says out in the world, through publications, through this and that, it would be better for him to go and take his own life. He would carry a smaller sin. These men, the Apostle Peter goes on to say, speaking great swelling words of vanity, they speak empty, exaggerated, inflated things. They entice through the lusts of the flesh, through licentiousness, those who had truly escaped, promising them liberty. They come to entice. To entice means to set out bait, to lay a trap, to set an offense, to set a stumbling block, through the lusts of the flesh, to throw them into the sins of the flesh. Even those who had genuinely escaped, who were clean children, who were pure children. They wanted to live the pure life, and someone pushes them, and that someone is in fact many. There are very many of them today. In our age, children, there are very many, And what do? They promise freedom, promising them liberty. They promise them freedom. Always you'll be set free. You'll get away from your home, from your parents, from their control, from all of society. You'll do whatever you want. You'll move however you please. What do these people do? They set an offense. And as the book of Numbers in the Old Testament also tells us, when the Moabites had grown afraid of the Hebrews, many of them were afraid because the Hebrews had encamped there near them. They called for that sorcerer Balaam, and upon that sorcerer God laid a restraint. He held him back from doing anything, telling him, "You will not speak beyond what I tell you." It is a long story. Read it for yourselves. It is in the book of Numbers, from chapter 25, onward. In the end, do you know what the evil one said to the king of the Moabites? "Do you know what you will do?" he says to the king. "Make their own god, come to hate them. Throw them into fornication and into idolatry. Throw them into fornication and into idolatry. Throw them into fornication and into idolatry. Then God will punish them, and you will get off free." Listen to how it puts it here. "And the Moabites," it says, "called them to the sacrifices of their idols, and the people ate of their sacrifices," meaning of the sacrifices of the idols, "and they bowed down to their idols." They worshiped the idols of the Moabites, and Israel was consecrated by the one performing the rite. That is, he carried out the ceremony. He held a service, a ritual, to Baal, Peor, one of the gods of the Moabites. And the Lord was kindled with anger against Israel. He grew angry. And you can conclude from this that the Hebrews did in the end kill Balaam. He did not get away. The money he took for this, as it says somewhere in the New Testament, he received the wages of unrighteousness, says the Apostle Peter. He says it plainly, the wages of unrighteousness is what he earned. He is named Balaam. In Greek, the name is Nicholas. And it is about this Nicolaitanism that Holy Scripture speaks, in the Apocalypse 2, in the book of Revelation. These are the ones, children, who set offenses so that the people of God will fall, so that those who lived the pure life, the clean life, will fall, sadly, into sin. But we still haven't settled the question, who is punished more? Both are punished. The Moabites punished. Forgive me, they led the Hebrews astray. But they too were punished. The Hebrews were punished as well. The Hebrews were punished as an example. They were not destroyed as a people. The Moabites were punished as an example, and they were destroyed as a people. So you see that the punishment of the Moabites was far greater than the punishment of the Israelites, and the one who leads another astray bears a greater sin than the one who is led astray. I would tell you further, if you have friends who, moved by ignorance and not by malice, would want to lead you into evil, say, "Let's go to a cafe." I told you, the spiritual child does not go to cafes. Say whatever you like. You want to go for a ride on your bicycle. Play. You want outings. You will not go to cafes nor to discos. Listen to how I put it, and he leads you astray, and you go there, and you go and dance. And you even get yourself a girlfriend, because your friend tells you, you know, that everyone does it that way. He pushed you into sin. He is not your friend. Is it ever possible for someone to be your friend who throws you into sin? Is it ever possible for such a person to be your friend? Friend means one who loves. Does this person love you? Of course, he doesn't do it out of malice. He does it out of ignorance. But if you now listen, learn, see, and understand, you will avoid a friend like this who would, against his own will. That is, he doesn't intend. As we said, your harm, yet he leads you into evil, and you will choose friends who will not push you toward evil, nor you them. On the contrary, each one will help the other so that you can attain the spiritual life. We covered only two questions tonight, children, but first, God willing, we will continue next Sunday.